Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure once again to present Kevin Coogan, the author of the consummately important recent volume Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, published in soft cover by Atano Media, copyright 1999. This is part two of For the Record program number 270. It is being recorded on January 21st of the year 2001. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
In the first part of our interview, we were talking about connections between the post-war fascist international and not only doctrinaire leftist and Soviet and Red Chinese elements, but also, to a certain extent, elements in what has come to be known as the Third World. And this goes against the ideological and conceptual grain of even relatively advanced American political scientific thinking, and I'd like to develop some of these connections still further. In one of our earlier interviews, we had a chance to touch on, though not very substantively, the Bandung Conference in Indonesia, which is actually where the concept of the Third World developed. And in that connection, we talked about a very influential, although little recognized figure named Haji Amin al-Husseini. I wonder if you could talk about the Bandung Conference, Haji Amin al-Husseini, and how this relates to such a far-right doctrinaire fascist like Francis Parker Yockey.
Well, the Bandung Conference is probably best known for the fact that it brought together people like Zhou Enlai from China, Tito from Yugoslavia, Nehru from India, and Sukarno from Indonesia. But one of the other people at the conference was, in fact, the Grand Mufti. Now, the mystery of the Grand Mufti is that he began in the 1930s as sort of the religious leader of the Palestinians in Jerusalem. But because of the British occupation of Palestine, the Palestinians began looking for allies, again, in kind of a geopolitical way, to sort of fight British control. And they naturally looked to the Germans, I should say in the same way that the Irish, some of the Irish anyway, some elements of the IRA also looked to the Germans. And if one looks at it even more deeply, you can see that some of these connections went back actually to World War I, when German and British intelligence were fighting over the Middle East at that time as well. So what happened with the Mufti is that the Mufti began making overtures to the Germans, and he began mobilizing his networks to support these uprisings against the British. Probably the best-known attempted uprising was in Iraq, which failed. I think that occurred in 1940. After the failure of the uprising, the Grand Mufti fled first to Italy and then to Germany. And he later went to Berlin, met with Hitler, and I believe set up a radio broadcasting network that was calling for Muslims to support the Third Reich. He also was involved in helping to form a Muslim division of the Waffen-SS to fight with the Germans. So the Grand Mufti had a lot of these connections even before World War II ended. After the war, he escaped to Egypt, and he set up camp there and was really one of the most influential leaders of the Palestinian movement for many, many years. While in Egypt, he helped create something called the World Muslim Congress. And the World Muslim Congress is notorious for circulating documents like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and things like that. If you look at the connections that the Grand Mufti had in the 1950s, for example, he had some of the most scurrilous people around the world, scurrilous anti-Semites, including Gerald L.K. Smith, who was a big right-winger in the United States. I mean, if you look at the Grand Mufti's publication, I think it's Muslim Congress News, you'll see that Gerald L.K. Smith is writing there regularly. So this is the Grand Mufti, and here he is popping up at the Bandung Conference. Now, in part, that it reflects the fact that, for example, Indonesia is a huge Muslim country. But the idea that the Grand Mufti could be involved with Bandung really reflects this whole broader question of geopolitics and of the fact that many countries saw, third world countries, saw the United States and the Soviet Union as the two superpowers that they had to sort of lever against each other to try and increase their own influence. And the most important area, really, where this took place was Egypt, when the United States and the Soviets were really trying to court Nasser. And finally, in the late 1950s, the Soviets won out. So the Grand Mufti's presence in something like Bandung is not completely surprising, given the fact that even before World War II, he himself was involved in sort of the rhetoric and also, to some degree, the reality of anti-imperialism, if you want to put it that way.
By the way, in past discussion of the World Muslim Congress, we've discussed its involvement with the former World Anti-Communist League as well.
Yes, the WMC was an active element in the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, which later became the World Anti-Communist League.
And probably received its most recent, if not best, publicity in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, in which Major General John Singlaub, the head of its American chapter for a time, was active, utilizing elements of the League on behalf of the Iran-Contra milieu.
I'd say the key person for the WMC during that period was a man named Inamullah Khan. And Inamullah Khan goes all the way back to the APACL.
In connection with Indonesia and the Bandung Conference, a name that we discussed in the first half of this interview, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, a name that I just love. That's his actual middle name, a former finance minister of the Third Reich. He was very active in Indonesia. Tell us about the Schacht-Indonesian connection.
Well, actually, I think the reason why he had that middle name is I think his mother was an American.
Right.
But Schacht was also involved with negotiations because Indonesia was, again, one of these third world countries where the Germans wanted to open up the business connections. And one of the ways that they saw to do this was to use their connections with the Grand Mufti. Now, this is not just simply Schacht. There was a very famous group in Germany called the Naumann Group, which began in the very late 1940s and went on into the 1950s. And the Naumann Group was primarily supported by elements in German heavy industry, because people like Naumann, who himself had been a very high official in Goebbels' propaganda ministry, and after Goebbels committed suicide, Naumann was appointed by Hitler to run the propaganda ministry. People like Naumann had very good connections in the Middle East, including in Iraq, where some of the Naumann group had ties with Mossadegh, the fellow who basically was brought down by the British and the Americans, but was one of the first nationalist leaders of Iraq. After Mossadegh was brought down, the Americans and the British put in the Shah of Iran. But at this time, the Germans saw, because Mossadegh had these connections, the Germans were thinking, hey, we can get business deals inside Iraq. So Schacht and Indonesia is simply part of a long chain of or interconnection between German heavy industry and some of these radical rightists who maintain very good ties with the Middle East because of anti-Semitism and opposition to Israel.
In connection with Werner Naumann, I want to mention that in our previous discussion of Naumann, we've discussed the fact that he was actually named to succeed Joseph Goebbels as propaganda minister.
Yes.
Of the Third Reich. And also, I want to mention that, ironically enough, even while Mossadegh, who was anti-American, was receiving the support of some of the post-war fascist international, when he was overthrown with the assistance of the CIA, the fellow who took his place was a guy named Fazola Zahedi, who had also worked for the Third Reich against the British in Iran during World War II. So again, even though fascism is a bitter ideological opponent of socialism or Marxism or Marxist-Leninism, at the same time, in terms of some of the practical alliances that are formed in the murky world of realpolitik, one wants to be very aware of some of these left, right, and third world fascist alliances. And Kevin, in that context, you have a chapter about Francis Parker Yockey and some of his dealings with the Soviets in the Soviet bloc called Lord Haha of the USSR. First of all, who was Lord Haha?
Well, Lord Haha was a man named William Joyce, who had been a member of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists, but later split with Mosley because he thought that Mosley was too moderate. During World War II, Joyce, who, if I remember correctly, was actually an Irish citizen, went to Germany and became a broadcaster, sort of in the Tokyo Rose type vein, where he broadcast to Allied troops, telling them that they should, Germany was going to win and they should give up. Later, after the war, he was executed as a traitor.
Now, you entitle an entire chapter, Lord Haw Haw of the USSR, with a question mark. Now, that is a reference to Francis Parker Yockey.
Yep.
If you could tell us why you, not necessarily the humor involved, but why would Yockey even be considered as a possible Lord Haw Haw of the USSR, given his doctrinaire fascist orientation?
Well, this comes about because Yockey had very close ties to the man named Fred Weiss, who was a German national who lived in the United States, but who maintained extensive connections with the post-war fascist international. And what happened is that at one point, Weiss was planning to send Yockey to East Germany, where he thought that Yockey could be used as a propagandist. And the way I came across all this is that there was a group, an anti-fascist research group in New York, called the Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League. And the Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League had an agent, really a kind of a mercenary for hire, who was working with Fred Weiss. And he basically, at one point, the mercenary, at one point Weiss was actually thinking about sending him to Germany to help out Yockey as well. And the actual phrase Lord Haw Haw actually comes from an FBI document, which is actually citing Weiss as saying that was Yockey's ambition, because Yockey, although he was an American, very much hated the United States.
Now, Kevin, in connection with the anti-Americanism of Yockey and the fascist milieu of which he was a part, you discuss something in Germany called the Bruderschaft, and I wonder if you would explain what the Bruderschaft was and how did this become involved in post-war German Realpolitik and the, for lack of a better term, the pro-Soviet inclinations of elements of the Bruderschaft and the pro-Atlanticist or pro-NATO inclinations of another element of this, and tie that in with the wooing of a very important German general named Heinz Guderian.
Well, I think the best way to approach the Bruderschaft is to look at it in terms of geopolitics. One has to understand that Germany, at least in my opinion, Germany after World War II followed much the same strategy as Germany after World War I. After World War I, Germany tried to rebuild itself and to lift the restrictions of the Versailles Treaty by making stabs both left and right. After World War I, for example, the Germans entered the Rapallo Treaty with Russia, and the Rapallo Treaty, behind the Rapallo Treaty, there was a secret agreement between the Red Army and the German Army, the Reichswehr, to help actually the Red Army to help build up the German army in secret. And so members of the German military actually went to Russia to train in the 1920s, and they had to go to Russia to train because the Versailles Treaty had all these restrictions on the German military, the size of the German military in Germany itself. Now, the Germans then kind of used that threat of overtures to the Reds to then go back to the West, to the Americans and the British, and to say, hey, we've got to be careful here. Maybe you should yourself ease up on the restrictions on Germany, because otherwise Germany could go even further in alliance with the Bolsheviks. So this idea of playing both sides to one's advantage was not something that just began overnight at the end of World War II. There is a definite outline for this policy in the post-war period in Germany. In World War I, and this is often referred to as sort of the Haushofer strategy. Haushofer was a German geopolitician who was very much committed to playing both sides of the game for Germany's advantage. So in that context, the Bruderschaft itself was an organization that began in a Allied POW camp, a British POW camp after the war, of elements
By the way, that's World War II.
World War II.
Right.
Of elements of the German military who were sitting around basically strategizing how we can get out of our dilemma. And what came out of the Bruderschaft were basically two currents. One current was headed by a man named Beck, and the other was headed by a man named Franke Grickshaw. And the Beck faction was a faction that said, well, the best thing we've got to do is we've got to orient to the Americans and the British. And the Franke faction said, well, we should orient towards the Russians. Now, Yockey was himself part of that group supporting the Franke faction. And there are many indications that Yockey actually met Franke in post-war Germany. What all factions, however, wanted to do is they wanted to weaken the war crimes trials process. And the idea was to force the restrictions on the German military to be lifted, and especially to get a lot of people who had been convicted as war criminals out of jail. So what the Beck group did is that the Beck group went to a guy named General Hans Guderian, and Beck became a kind of an intermediary between Guderian and the Allies. Guderian was not himself a war criminal. He was actually a very famous tank commander for the Germans in World War II. But Guderian had enormous clout inside the German military and was extremely well respected. And what Guderian was essentially saying is that, look, if you want the Germans to fight against the Russian menace in the Cold War, we will not do anything for you until you begin releasing our boys from jail. Now, this was then counterposed to people like Yaki and Franca, who were saying, hey, why should we fight for the Americans when all the Americans plan to do in the Cold War is to sort of use Germany as a battleground, where undoubtedly if a war breaks out between Russia and the United States, nuclear weapons will be used in Germany by both the Russians and the Americans. So they began this policy of advocating an extreme form of neutralism. And this later resulted in the creation of a group called the Socialist Reich Party, the SRP, led by a man named Raymer, who was a very important figure in the post-war German far right.
By the way, the full name Otto Ernst Raymer, an SS man and one of the people involved in administering, quote, justice, unquote, to the July 1944 plotters against Hitler. Continue, Kevin.
People like Raymer were saying with the Socialist Reich Party, what we should do is we should actually advocate a policy of neutralism so that Germany would not be caught up in the Cold War period. And you have very funny meetings in the early 1950s where people from the Socialist Reich Party are actually at anti-war congresses arm-in-arm with people from both the Communist Party and the Socialist Party because they were so much advocates of this kind of radical neutralism. So essentially, the way I see all this is I sort of see the World War II maneuvers, the post-World War II maneuvers, kind of in the template of what happened after World War I, that the Germans in a certain sense were almost like a third world country where they too were caught between the two superpowers, the United States and the Russians, both of which sort of occupied parts of Germany, and they were trying to play one off against the other.
Now, we also, by the way, by way of review, we talked about some of the struggle between the anti-American and pro-NATO or pro-Atlanticist factions of post-World War II fascism in Italy, and we were talking about Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese and some others in connection with the philosophy of Julius Evola and some of the fascist elements involved in the strategy of tension. We won't have time to go into that, but by way of cross-referencing with some of our earlier discussions about these ideological struggles and some of these very strange alliances developed by Realpolitik. Kevin, in the first part of our interview, we were talking about a couple of people named Fred Weiss and also H. Keith Thompson, both of them German intelligence agents operating before, during, and after World War, Nazi intelligence agents, so operating before, during, and after World War II in some capacity, also liaising in that capacity with Francis Parker Yaki. One of the strangest involvements of Messrs. Weiss, Thompson, and Yaki was with an organization called the New Renaissance Party that you jokingly refer to, or in a jocular title, refer to as the New York Nazis. First of all, what does the title New Renaissance Party allude to?
Well, actually, it's actually the National Renaissance Party.
Or, excuse me, the National Renaissance Party.
And the National Renaissance Party was named after a phrase in, I think, Hitler's Last Will and Testament, where he talks about a new renaissance of Germany that will emerge from the flames of defeat.
Actually, yeah, that's right. It was actually a new renaissance of National Socialism. That was confusing, the title and with the allusion. Okay, go ahead.
That's it. What the National Renaissance Party was essentially, it was a group that came out of the old Bund networks in New York. The Bund being the German-American Bund, which was the very virulently pro-Hitler group in the 1930s, combined with supporters of Father Coughlin, who was an extreme right-wing Catholic priest, and others who had been sort of underground in the immediate post-war period but began to emerge a little bit into the light by 1949, 1950 when the National Renaissance Party gets set up. But the interesting thing about the National Renaissance Party is that when it was founded, it was largely founded by Fred Weiss, who used a man named James Madol, the titular head of the NRP, as a kind of a front man to carry out propaganda that Weiss wanted circulated. So, for example, Weiss had his own printing house called LeBlanc Publishing, and he would print Holocaust denial literature, and then the troops of the National Renaissance Party would then distribute it both here and abroad. Now, the National Renaissance Party was one of the most visible and one of the first groups to sort of dress up in stormtrooper-type imitation uniforms and carry out propaganda. And because they were so extreme in their presence, and they would have these sort of street corner rallies in New York on 86th Street in the old German section of New York, where Madol would rant and rave, that they got they convey the impression of a kind of like a Nazi-like sectarian group.
This group again illustrates some of the crossed ideological wires, I guess one could say, in an effort to promote an anti-American and pro-fascist and yet anti-American agenda by some of these elements. Again, we've mentioned that Yaki, Fred Weiss, and Thompson all liaised with this milieu.
Yes.
The National Renaissance Party actually endorsed people like Nasser in Egypt, Castro again in Cuba, and even had operational connections with some black nationalist or black separatist groups in the United States.
Yes, this is one of the fascinating things about the National Renaissance Party. And it also, when one realizes that they had such unusual positions, you can also understand why other groups inside the far right, for example, George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party, despised the National Renaissance Party because he thought they were somehow, communist connected in some bizarre way. But the National Renaissance Party, from a very early period, for example, was very much involved in promoting Nasser. And when you look at National Renaissance Party publications, you can see that they are distributing things from the Egyptian Ministry of Information in support of Egypt, for example, during the 1956 war. And then when one later thinks about it and you realize that Leers, Johann von Leers, the former Goebbels ministry official, who later became head of propaganda, of anti-Zionist propaganda for Nasser in the 1950s, really what was happening is that the National Renaissance Party was a conduit to help distribute propaganda put out by Leers. So it's really not that surprising when one sort of reflects on it. The NRP was also very much pro-Castro, and the NRP, at one point, the NRP would actually have rallies and meetings in support of Castro. They were also very much in support of the Chinese. And I have in my book one incident where George Lincoln Rockwell, this is before he actually formally created the American Nazi Party, shows up as an honored guest at an NRP meeting where they're praising China and they're praising Cuba. And the NRP was also involved, for example, in distributing propaganda from the Cubans after the Cuban Revolution. So they're one of these groups that absolutely, from a conventional right-left standpoint, would seem to make no sense at all. But not surprisingly, when you look behind the NRP, you see the presence of both Fred Weiss and then Yaki.
And bear in mind that the uniting denominator, so to speak, is anti-Americanism. Utilizing quote anti-imperialism unquote as a screen behind which to operate.
Well, in the way they did that, for example, with the black nationalists, they took up the fact that Nasser was, for example, supporting the Mau Mau insurgency against the British in Kenya. So the NRP began working with some famous Harlem black nationalists and also a group called the African Universalist Church, which was a black separatist organization. And because you have to remember, as racists, the NRP supported segregation.
Sure.
And so they saw that these black nationalists also supported segregation. And I have a report in my book that at one point the NRP and one of these groups had a meeting in a black church in Harlem. and all the whites sat on the left, you know, and all the blacks sat on the right.
Separate but equal.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, and the remarkable thing that at the same time the NRP was dealing with these black nationalist groups in Harlem, at the same time they were developing very strong connections with these ultra-right wing white nationalist groups, particularly the National States Renaissance Party. And the National States Renaissance Party had liaison. National States Rights Party had liaison with the Renaissance Party.
One of the things to remember too is that at the same time, groups like the NSRP and the Ku Klux Klan were bitterly anti-black, and just as the many of the Latin American and Mediterranean fascist elements were very and bitterly active against people like Castro, yet you find other elements of the fascist milieu, particularly those seeking to utilize either leftist or anti-imperialist third world factions against the United States, taking an opposite tack. We're down to our last couple of minutes here, Kevin. And you mentioned that the NRP actually had sort of a schizophrenic attitude or operational attitude towards the former Soviet Union. That some were showing up at anti-Soviet demonstrations,
yes,
and some at pro-Soviet demonstrations.
Yes, what happened is that the National Renaissance Party, its leadership really was directed, in my opinion, by Fred Weiss, using James Madol as sort of his puppet. But they needed bodies, and a lot of people, real Nazi types, I mean, people also who were, you know, juvenile delinquents and people who had spent time in jail, and just fanatical personalities in general, showed up and made up the ranks of the NRP. And a lot of these people were just simply kind of hardcore, sort of proto-skinhead type elements. And one of the amusing things is that when Khrushchev came to speak before the UN, there was a rally led by Hungarians, who were exiled after 1956, after the 1956 Hungarian uprising was crushed by Khrushchev and the Russians. They organized a massive demonstration against Khrushchev outside the Russian mission. And some of the people, some of Madol's street fighters showed up in support of the demonstration. Now, Madol at that time was back-channeling meetings with a Russian diplomat, and I discuss all this in my book, and he was very upset because at the same time he's meeting with this Russian, his cronies or his mates are out demonstrating against Khrushchev.
Kevin, in our next visit, I'd like to talk about some of the overlaps between elements like the NRP and other fascist elements and elements of the occult. We see these reflected in a number of different areas, but we are all out of time. We've been visiting with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, published in soft cover by Otano Media, and copyright 1999. Otano Media can be found at P.O. Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568. Phone and fax 718-963-2603. Their website is www.autonomedia.org. The book was edited by WFMU-FM Jersey City air personality Dave Mandel. And our previous interviews with Kevin Coogan are available from Spitfire. That is available at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail@spitfirelist.com. You can see a list of a description of this interview, For the Record 270, and the other broadcasts I've done on the Spitfire website, equipped with real audio, at www.spitfirelist.com. And note that the aforementioned WFMU-FM Jersey City is now archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, and you can visit their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and you can email me at demory@kfjc.org. That concludes For the Record program number 270, being recorded on January 21st of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. For Kevin Coogan, thanks for listening.